Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Stephen the Warman Writes Kickfighting Podcast Show. I'm your host, Stephen the Warman. You are listening to this podcast in one of two ways. Either you are at my blog, which is lordgaul.podbean.com, or you are at the most efficient way to get the show. Just enter Warman Kickfighting Show into the iTunes search engine, or enter Lord Gaul into the iTunes search engine, and the show pops right up. Lord Gaul, of course, was my username back when I fell in love with the sports, back when I was on, all the fight forums, K1 USA, Kakatugi, K1 fans, and so on. So definitely shout out to all those longtime listeners who know me from way back then. But still, even though I make my money and, as a trainer, a kid who once upon a time had the love and dream of going to Japan and fighting in K1, that opportunity in that world has changed a lot. Opportunities are different. There's probably more fight opportunities now. But shout out to everybody who knew me way back when I was a dreamer, to a guy who became a pretty successful coach with combat sports athletes. So I'm definitely grateful for the position that I'm in. We're going to have fun today. Going to go back into the summer series. I know I've got a couple fights coming up. Shinichai comes, he fights on Kunlun this weekend, and we've had a couple of sporadic events here and there. There's been fight news, but I'm going to go into my fight series. I'm going to go back to my summer series of things that I wanted to talk about that happened over the internet era, as I've called it, of kickboxing. So I'm really going to focus on things, at the earliest you might have hear me mention something around 1996, 97. But for the most part, it's, those dates to today are the athletes and events that I'm focused on. Also, I've got a special, special episode coming up for those of you who are hardcore into to Muay Thai. I am going to have a really, really two long shows that I'm going to have, and I'm going to stream them all together. So I wasn't able to get you guys last week because one of my fighters, his name's Abdul Al-Hassan, and he took a short notice fight, and that's why I wasn't able to get this podcast up last week. I had to travel and prepare for something short notice, and, he's very, very talented, so we were successful. He's 5-0 now, but that kept me from having the time to sit down and go through this list properly. But I really wanted to have a fun and have a lot of fun and show you guys the athletes that I really think are exceptional today. Exceptional athletes who, they are not the norm. They are not guys who had successful fight careers. There's a lot of people who've had successful fight careers, and not all of them are necessarily champions or Hall of Famers who have a different route about things. These are people who we saw coming. I'll give you an example. Andy Sauer has a great win record. He has a great win record. But the buzz about him coming up wasn't so much based on his athleticism, despite his record. He did have a lot of great fight opportunities early, got to fight for S Cup very, very early, shoot boxing very, very early in his life. He's very, very young when he first went against Albert Krauss in K1. He's a guy who he turned into the great later. He still had good wins. He still had good wins throughout, so that's not what I'm saying. But if you look at his resume early and you look at his resume to the 2003 on, that's where you kind of see the legend kind of pop out. But definitely he's not a guy who you heard the buzz about skill set wise before he got up. Another person, and I was really, really torn on him, Remy Bonjasky, also not one of the guys on the list. Remy Bonjasky was a guy who people felt had a lot of tools for kickboxing, but Remy never had the KO pop. He never really had kickboxing consistency once he got to the high level. Like, he would beat a Ray Seffel, then he'd lose to a Gerald Venetian. He had losses to like Errol Parris, who's, you got to be a junkie to know who Errol Parris is in kickboxing. He had some inconsistency early on. His breakout was when he had the 2003 K1 Grand Prix in Vegas. It's not that he didn't have big wins before that, but he actually lost to Semi Shelton kickboxing before that opportunity came up. So another guy who's my hero in kickboxing, he would not make the list of guys who had that buzz. He was one of those guys who had that, this could be the next guy from Holland. So that's, I'm not excluding him from that. But the guys who I'm really going to focus on, I'm going to make an argument for why I feel there was a period of time that these athletes were the athletes. The guy who you were like, this is going to be the person to watch for time to come. This is the person who is just there's something different about this individual, okay? So I'm talking prospects. So for those of you who are big boxing fans, if you heard of Errol Spence Jr. early, you would have known that going into that Olympics, everybody who, you know, when I was around the boxing circles that I'm around, and I'm here in Texas, and then I was in Vegas for a little bit, they had already known that this was the kid of that class. This was the kid. Now, others have gotten fight, you know, championship aspirations before him. They've gotten their chance to fight for a title. You know, the heavyweight did this past year. Didn't go his way, but he got that opportunity. But you could clearly see that there is something different about Errol Spence Jr., and you saw it from the beginning. The prospects that I'm going to bring you are guys that you see something different about before they ever got to the highest level. So let's go ahead and go for a ride. I'm going to take you through these athletes. Now, some of you guys are going to have your own names, and some of you guys are going to be like, what about XYZ? I'm going to give you my list, and I'm going to make an argument for every person that I mention. You can run with it or not run with it. And there's one more thing I better add to this before I get started. Not all of these guys turned out to be great fighters. Very, very important. And for those of you who watch elite prospects throughout the years, it's something that you see quite common. There are people that have all the tools to be successful in combat sports for a very long time, in kickboxing for a very long time, in Muay Thai for a very long time. But when I look at the bulk of the resume, when I look at what the barometer of success is, what they're judged by, and for heavyweights, the barometer of your success was how well you did in the K-1 World Grand Prix. A lot of those guys, some of the guys on my list didn't touch it. For guys who, you know, fought at 70 kgs, their benchmark was the K1 Max. Some of those guys weren't able to have success there. Some of those guys didn't touch it. It's very important that as you guys go through this list, don't judge me off of, well, this person didn't win the K1 World Grand Prix. Semi Schilt won, you know, 4 K1 World Grand Prix. And I look at his career and I look at where he came from and I look at who he is and I go, you know what? Despite that, he is not a guy who was on this list. He was not some prospect that you saw at a young age and you're like, this is going to be the guy. He was doing a completely different sport when he emerged on the scene. So it's important that you guys know that before I go into my list. I'll go ahead and get this started. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm excited to get this list. I was sitting down and breaking it down and going through it. I'll jump around. I'll go to guys, and I'll make an argument for everybody that I use. So I'll go ahead and first start off with, we will go with Artur Kashenko. Here's the thing about Artur Kashenko, and this is why he was such a talented young man when he burst on the scene. First of all, there was a K1 East European Grand Prix, and I remember when it was announced, and I remember seeing the names in the list, and I was like, oh, okay. Marius Zaromski, he had a really, really cool MMA highlight at that time. And he, of course, if you guys know Zaromski, he has all these really cool backflips and all this kind of cool stuff that he does, you know, as far as like, you know, when you saw his first highlight, things that he just did that were just out of the norm as a fighter. And it made people in the international scene want to have this guy on their fight cards. So when the K1 East Europe Grand Prix was put together, he was the guy who I thought was going to win it. I was like, cool, this guy who's got all this athleticism and all this flash, this guy is going to be the one that's going to emerge from this, you know, this East Europe Grand Prix, and he's going to fight in K1 on a regular basis. Awesome. I can't wait to have this guy. He is all over the place. So I was really, really excited. So I see this guy, I see this list, and then all of a sudden, a kid named Artur Kashenko, who must have been, I want to say he was 18 at the time, maybe 19, he wins the tournament clear. And then I started to hear buzz that there was this guy who had all these athletic tools, not just these athletic tools, but he had this style where, you know, he could throw in volume. And for those of you who saw Artur Kashenko when he first came up, he could rip to the body like no other. He had amazing combinations to kick volume, not just necessarily a combination of low kick volume, but he could go kick to hands and hands to kick like no other. He had this really thin frame, and he looked super young. He looked really, really boyishly young, like he was like 12 when you first saw him, like just as young as he could possibly get. And he came out, and he had all these athletic gifts. He had the height, he had the size, but most importantly for K1, he had the look. And for those who don't understand it, K1 was a TV show, and the K1 Max in particular was a TV show, and it tailored to an audience of, I wouldn't be surprised if it was 50-50 men and women. I wouldn't be surprised if it was 55-45 women to men. It was tailored off of a young audience of, you know, late teens, early 20s. That's, if you look in the K1 crowd, you saw a lot of that there. If you saw a lot of those K1 Max cards, you look through the audience. Clearly, K1 was the brand, so people brought their families to K1. Like, it was, Kakutugi was so big, like, it was like a family event to kind of do it. So you'll look at the audience, and you'll see full families watching, Peter Arts win the K1 World Grand Prix and so on. But the Max was different. The Max was supposed to be, that's why they had the crazy production. That's why they had, the entrances, they had the vids, the VRs, like, all these things to really sell you on the athletes being more than just people who go in there and compete. There had to be story to them. They had to have substance to them. But for the Max, they had to have that look. So clearly, it doesn't mean that, you know, if you were a good fighter, but you didn't have that look, and you had a great story, they could use you, you know. If you were a good fighter, but you were too old, they could use you. They just didn't use you as much. So I don't want to disregard any of those athletes who feel like maybe they missed their opportunity to fight in K1 because they didn't have the look. That's just the nature of how they did business. And Artur Kuryashenko, he had all those tools. So he gets his opportunity on the, in a K1 Max super fight with Ryan Simpson. And it's crazy because they're in two different directions. Simpson's at the end of his career, so this is really good, a good opportunity for him to fight on what was considered the biggest stage in kickboxing for his weight class. And I'd say it was even a little bit below his weight class. But after a Hall of Fame career, Ryan Simpson ends up on that card. And he ends up fighting Artur Kuryashenko. Decently close fight, but I gave, and the cards gave it to the rightful winner, Artur Kuryashenko. But that just kind of let people know, this guy is a little bit different. A little bit different than some of the other prospects we used before. And then from there on, he went on to show it. Of course, you guys know about the Hall of Fame. We don't have a Hall of Fame in kickboxing and Muay Thai. If we did, Artur Kuryashenko would definitely be in it. You look at the run that he had, K1 Max, you look at those opportunities. Just an awesome fighter who's, here's the most interesting thing about Artur Kuryashenko as you look at him now. His career, his fight style has changed so much. I can look and I can see three legitimately different fight styles that he used to have success at different levels and different weight classes and different times in his life. Just an exceptional, exceptional fighter. So Artur Kuryashenko is the first "this kid's got all the tools" guy to pay attention to that I have on my list. I'm going to go ahead and move on. I'm going to have some fun, jump all over the place. We're going to go with a straight Muay Thai fighter. Liam Harrison from England, 1999 to 2005. You know how many fights he lost? Rhymes with hero. Liam Harrison was unstoppable until July of 2005. He's a guy who got into the sport very, very early. He went to Bad Company Gym, which was run by Richard Smith, who was a fighter himself. He opened the gym up in his hometown of Leeds. And he, at a very young age, gets a young Liam Harrison to walk through his doors. It's crazy because Muay Thai was hot in the 90s. People don't understand how big it was. It may not have paid the most money all the time, but it did have a lot of international opportunities and a lot of opportunities to compete on a regular basis. So time and space matters for this sort of thing. Enter Liam Harrison, who's coming in as a, teenager as he goes into the gym, and he gets to see all of the, he hears about Richard Smith, telling him about Thailand, selling him on this, this dream, and he kind of makes it his own, and kind of makes the sport his own, and he goes into it full. When I first heard about him, I was always looking for a magazine that had kickboxing or K1, and of course they didn't have it. I'm in America. And then one day, they had a magazine called Fighters, not Fighters Only, just called Fighters, and it was English-based. It was a huge magazine. Like, it looked like some old book that you would find in the back of a library somewhere. It was just huge for a magazine. So it was like maybe, twice the size of your regular size magazine. And I'm looking at it and had a kickboxer in the front of it. I was like, cool. Finally got a magazine with kickboxer on it. And the second edition that I was ever able to get a hold of had Liam Harrison on the cover. And then I go into it and I hear about Liam Harrison, who is 19 at the time. And at the time, he was the WAKO world champion. It's not as significant, right now, but at the time, that was a big deal. And it had his story. You know, it was him, and it had Bad Company, and it had, you know, their GM, Andy Housen, and you know, it talked about their athletes. But it did a nice little piece on him, and I'm like, okay, this young guy's got all the tools. Not only was he fighting, he's the first English guy to consistently. Other English people had fought, you know, Kieran Kettle and so on. Other guys had fought, guys from Thailand, whatever. But this kid, at a very consistent pace, at a very young age, started to really challenge himself against elite Thais. And again, it brought losses, but it also brought victories. It brought international opportunities. But we're talking about a guy who had combination punch. He had good style. He had a great body kick. And then he had this great moment in his career, great, good, and bad, where he went against Anuwat. I mean, goes against Anuwat. Anuwat in Jamaica beats him with low kicks, you know, and he was out of action for a long time. But then that made him, another person, focus on his style a little bit. And then all of a sudden, he adopted a very aggressive low kick game. He had low kick success before, but he adopted it after that fight. Next time he went against Anuwat, he beat him. And this is a young guy who grew into, and he's still, you know, a decently young guy. But this is a person who had all the tools. You heard the buzz about him. He hasn't fought a guy in England, from England, for a very, very long time. That just shows he kind of wiped out his division in the country. Country makes it. It's unanimous. This is going to be the kid to watch as he goes out in the international scene. And he really did. He's a guy who I would say fulfilled the prophecy. He's still out there fighting, still out there competing. Had the opportunity to fight in K1. You know, in their tournament, was winning a fight before a knee to the head, to the eye cut him. Just the nature of the sport. But man, special talent early on that was able to turn it into something. But again, a kid who you saw had the tools very, very early on. Liam Harrison out of England. We will keep moving on. I am going to go ahead and go with, let's go to the ladies. Jemima Betrain, based out of Holland. Jemima Betrain is, of course, you've got this long line of very, very successful female fighters in Holland. You know, they've got great trainers, got great athletes. So, of course, you've got, you know, your Jermaine Durandamis. You've got your Lucia Rikers. You've got some very successful female fighters that kind of took over this is the next it person for us. Enter very young Jemima Betrain. Jemima Betrain catches fire. First of all, she's an exceptional athlete. And the way that people talked about the athleticism of a Tiffany Von Seuss, for example. Tiffany Von Seuss, older when she got into the sport. She had already gone to college, had a soccer career, played soccer in college. She enters the sport in her, you know, early 20s. She may have started earlier, but she entered the fight scene in her early 20s. But Jemima Betrain's been doing this since her teen years, and a lot of kids are like that. So you'll hear, you know, a lot of the Dutch fighters talk about the first time they walked in the gym. It happened when they were like 13. So like their middle school in America, middle school into high school, around 12, 13, 14 is when a lot of them start. So Jemima Betrain gets that start, and she's got this exceptional athleticism, and she has this crazy work rate and the kind of recklessness of I can't be hurt. That just made her so tough to beat early on. So Jemima comes out there with, you know, she's, you know, the athleticism, the strength. She get in your face, and then she has a good combination and kick game. But she had legitimate KO pop, which developed more as she kind of went from 17, 18, 19. But early on, you know, in those years, as that's developing, she just was such an awesome athlete and had so much volume. Even if girls were able to score offense on her, they couldn't keep her off. They couldn't keep her off of them. She was just too mean, too aggressive, too much pace, too much pushing. And the next thing you know, you look at the scorecards and you're down a lot after round one. And then some period of time, if you got out of round one, round two, you're not fighting anymore. The volume is just too much. And a lot of girls just went down because she was just so aggressive and so strong. She's had victories over Christine Toledo. It's Christine Toledo, who, of course, you guys know, she's a very successful fighter in America, had a good Muay Thai career and now runs Lion Fight. She had a victory over Lim Soo-jung. Lim Soo-jung, a very successful fighter who also had a lot of success early in her career, a Korean-based fighter, had victories over Rina of shoot boxing. And then we have Linda Ohms. Linda Ohms was like the first, like, I believe she was English-based, but she was one of the main international players in Muay Thai very early on. Wasn't a great athlete, but Linda Ohms had good volume, and she knew how to fight. She knew how to find her offense, and she ran into Jemima Betrain, and it was not so. Betrain was the better of those two. Lorena Klein, another girl who's more known for MMA, she's had some shoot boxing opportunities. She still gets a lot of kickboxing fights. Her style's not the best. Nevertheless, Jemima Betrain had success with her. Just not one of the best resumes of a teenager that you're going to hear about. She's in her early 20s now, but most of these fights that I'm talking about happened between 17 and 19 years old. So, but Jemima Betrain, one of the young stars from Holland that you want to pay attention to, Jemima Betrain, I believe I spelled that correctly. But Jemima Betrain, definitely one to pay attention to right off the jump. We will continue to go through our list. We're trying to jump all over the world. It's a lot more fun when I do it that way. And I am going to take you to Artem Levin. Artem Levin was this very wiry guy who had a lot of fight opportunities because he kept fighting, and a lot of Russian fighters do this to this day. He kept fighting in both Russia, in both amateur fighting and pro fighting. So any opportunity he got to fight, he would. And that's very, very common. So, I believe he's officially mastered the sport in Russia. Any opportunity he had to compete, he did, and he excelled at it. We're talking about this guy who I call him the bully. And I called him the bully because if you watch some of his early fights, he wasn't playing. Like little things in a clinch. One of my most popular fighters, Johnny Hendricks. And when he was a college wrestler, people hated him as a college wrestler because they said he did dirty things. So, like, if the ref called you out of bounds, Johnny would always give you a little push because he felt like it meant you had to come back to the center that much longer it took you to get back to the center, or that much longer you had to deal with him touching you or being on you or being heavy on you and so on. Like, he said those little things mattered to him. So he would just do those little things to kind of get on you. If you ever got in a clinch with Artem Levin, it was the worst decision of your life. Because not only was he big and strong and he could throw offense, elbows, knees from any position, but if you guys ended up on the ropes, I've seen him try to push guys out of the ropes, over the top, and through them. He does not play. He is so aggressive. If you go on the ground, you can throw that strike in Muay Thai. People are headed to the ground. Artem's taking that strike. Artem was such an aggressive guy. And again, as he's fought at a bigger weight, he's become a savvy boxer. Like, I'm telling you, he's a guy who's had, I can't stress to you enough, and this has happened again, this is the third person that I've mentioned this on, he was able to adopt a different style as he grew in size. Because Artem Levin is not a big middleweight for the glory weight division, their glory middleweight division. He's not big for that. I think it's around 187 pounds. He is not a big guy for that weight class. I'm not saying that he can't put on good weight, but I'm saying he's not a big guy. Like, Simon Marcus is a big, strong dude. You see Simon Marcus, you're like, oh, yeah, this guy is clearly meant for this division. And he's been meant for that division for a very, very long time. You look at the body of Artem Levin, and you're like, this guy is, got some, it's not fat, but it's not toned. But he's got this savvy movement and this boxing and these angles, and all that comes from fighting all the time and place sparring all the time. And he developed his identity. He's developed it in both stances. That is a new style of fighting for him. What you see in Artem Levin is new. When he fought, even if you go back to the days of him fighting in the Showtime, this guy had such strength in the weight class. You look at his fight with Melvin Grunhardt, for example. He just bullied him. Melvin couldn't hurt him, so he just kept walking him down, landing big offense. Finally, after winning four rounds in a row, he's able to stop Myrtle Grunhardt in the fifth round. And I'm like, that's how the bully gets down. He ain't playing. When he fought at 77 kgs, he was tough as they come. And he used to fight lower. He fought, got victories over Alexander Setsurenko. Setsurenko got him back, but he got victories over him. He got a victory over Kim Sit-sung-Pyeong very early on. I want to say early 2000s. Kim Sit-sung-Pyeong, of course, known for having a lot of international success, having a lot of international opportunities. He was a good tie in the international scene, not a great tie in the international scene. Marzo, another person, based out of Australia for a long time. Marzo good international fighter, not great international fighter, but he was one of the Thais to really, I might even do a whole episode on Thais who got international opportunities in the early 2000s. But Marzo was one of those guys. IMFA champion, WMC champion back when it had value. He really was, you know, a legitimate fighter. And then, of course, he was made famous for his first breakout fight, which was against Yotsen Klei. Yotsen Klei stopped him, I want to say, in the second round. It was just a one-sided fight in favor of Yotsen Klei the first time they met. But he was a young guy, and that was the fight that kind of introduced him to the world. But people, he had that buzz before the fight. People were saying, this guy's going to put up a good fight. This is a kid to watch. He's very, very good. Didn't go that way for that night. But he was able to get a victory off of Yotsen Klei in an amateur event down the road. So, Artem Levin, tall for the weight class, bully tactics, mean clinch, different angles and styles, sneaky head kick. He is one of the guys that was one of the prospects that you heard about early on, and then he became something down the road. I am going to go ahead and let's go to Japan for the next one. We are going to go ahead and go to Japan, and we are going to talk about, oh, you knew it was coming. For anybody who watched my podcast at all, you listened to my podcast at all, you knew Masaaki Nori's name was coming up. So Masaaki Nori is a guy who still very young now. I want to say he's 22 or 23. But he burst on the scene because K1 had this thing where they were trying to find new young talent. And basically they had it in a brand called Koshin. And Koshin was showing young amateur-style fighters. They'd compete in a tournament. And then the winner of the tournament would get to fight on, you know, TV. And then it was a way of kind of, again, it's that appeal to TV. So it served two purposes. The first purpose, of course, was it wanted to appeal to, its first purpose is they wanted to find new talent. Masato was getting older at the time. Masato has already been talking about retirement before he had officially retired. They needed young Japanese stars to take over. They had guys who had showed, you know, moments here and there, but nothing consistent. They wanted to know who was the next person to follow, who was the next young star to follow. So they put together this brand, Koshin, and they put it together under the idea that this young kid named Hiroya was going to be the next champion. Hiroya had he wasn't good-looking like Masato was. Like, a lot of people were like, Masato, the girls love Masato. Some girls watch fights just to see Masato and his look. As I talked about with Arthur Kashinka before, he had the look. The girls liked that look. He was a young guy. He was around that age. He had the talent and the look. Masato had the talent and the look. Hiroya didn't have that as much. Like, when I talked to people from Japan on the forum, they always thought that Hiroya was, you know, a little bit too boyish, I'd heard, but maybe a little bit too forced. I'll get into that in a little bit. But he didn't have that as much. But he had a style that looked like it was similar to Masato's style. It was boxing heavy. He had low kicks, but man, he had boxing, and they were like, this is going to be the kid. So in the way that Satake, K1 was birthed on Satake and his success, Masato, K1 Max, was birthed on his success and his idea of being a person that they could market to the Japanese brand. Hiroya was the guy for the Koshin brand. Like, he was going to be the one that was going to push them into the future. So we go into who he is, his identity, and so on. The Koshin identity and what they are trying to accomplish. They were a TV show bringing in young talent. So they had all these young kids trying out headgear, shin guards, and they were in these two-minute, like, one-round fights. So you really had to, like, put in volume and really separate yourself. In that, there was a guy named Masaaki Nori. There were a couple other ones that really, Koyarube, he definitely stands out as a very successful fighter that came out of that. But the whole idea was Hiroya was supposed to be the man. And then the first year that they did it, a guy named Masaaki Nori ruined their plans by beating Hiroya and beating Shota Shimada to take the first championship. I believe it was the first or the second, but I believe he took the first one. And then the following year, Hiroya won, and then the third year, someone else won. But we, as young kickboxing fans, we loved it that they were getting this opportunity. We hated that it was on TV. We hated that they did Koshin. They took away from one of our pro spots that should be belonging to a Mike Zambides. It should be belonging to a Albert Krauss. It should be belonging to a Bacow. We can't have you make those one-round fights so you can show the full fight of your Heroya product. So not everybody was a fan of this when it happened. Despite this, enter Masaki Nori. He was this kid who had a really, really good low kick and body kick whip. Head kick, his kick whip in general was just so super fast. So in the video that they show, his VR, one of them, they had this guy come in and hold pads for him. And again, he didn't have a big, strong-hipped body kick in the way that a Jotunklai does. He has this really quick whip at his hip and just shoots one of the fastest kicks you're ever going to see. It comes off lightning. It is a lightning kick. So he would shoot that from his hip super, super fast, and he would score it. And the video, they had a guy come in and put the pads on, and he kills the guy in the pads. He came out, and he had all these tools real early on. After Koshin kind of comes to an end, he starts to make his way through, you know, Crush and Rise, and he's getting these kickboxing opportunities. And every time he fights, someone's out there making sure that they upload his fight, and you're seeing all the tools. Again, we're watching a 17-year-old kid, 17, 18. He's got this mean low kick whip. He's got this patient style. He could dig to the body with his wiry frame. He is super fast twitch athlete. You saw all the tools early on. Now he's probably the second best or third best fighter in the world in the weight class of 65 kg or 60. What is this? It's 65 kgs. Regularly, he's got victories over Liam Harrison. As I mentioned before, he had the knee. He had trouble with Yuta Kubo, comes back, finally beats Yuta Kubo, figures him out. Kim Sitsong, Kufair Texas, the champion in the weight class, rightful best in the world. But he had a very competitive close fight with him. He just didn't have the volume to win the fight. But you could see when you watch that, these are one and twos. The only difference is Kufair Texas doesn't have the mental lapse loss here and there. He just beats everybody. The only time that you can make an argument for it was his, you know, loss that he had Philip Kimura. But he still, if you look at that fight, he was still winning the fight despite the big shot that Philip landed. So Masaki Nori in that weight class, which is one of the best weight classes in the world right now, that weight class is hot. 65 kgs has got a lot of talented guys. He's one of the best. Very, very talented guy, young guy who fulfilled the prophecy, and he was able to get to that high level and be known by a lot of guys. I'm going to go ahead and go off the beaten track with these next two. I'm going to name a couple of American guys, and it is going to throw you off when you hear me name them, but I'm going to go ahead and say it because you can make the argument that neither one of these guys captured their best potential. The next two guys I'm going to talk about are Carter Williams and Kit Cope. Carter Williams, when he first burst on the scene, he was a kickboxer. He had some regional success. But again, in America, in the 2000s, MMA started to get hot. And after the Ultimate Fighter, the first Ultimate Fighter, MMA got really hot. But we were still always trying to produce somebody who could compete on the international level. And we had sent guys to K1 before. None of them had great success. K1, unfortunately, came right after, and he was smaller anyways, but it came right after Rick Rufus was having his success. Rick Rufus, clearly one of the great kickboxers ever. But K1 and its brand came a little bit after he was at his great point. So his opportunities, he had a loss to Filho, and he didn't really have consistent, Francisco Filho, he had a loss to him. He didn't have consistent run in the 90s like he had in the 80s. So with that not happening, with some of the other guys that we had, California-based guys who had the opportunity to fight K1, those guys weren't able to have success. They were always looking for the next big star. When K1 first came over to America, they came over and they did a card in Vegas, and they brought their stars. They brought, we had Lecco, we had Peter Arts, we had the elite guys. But they still needed to, if they're going to make this American thing work, they needed to make a kickboxer work locally. What I mean by locally, I mean in America. Now, Dewey Cooper, very successful coach right now. He had an all right kickboxing career, and he kept getting opportunities to be in the K1 Grand Prix because he was this guy who always he was small, quick for the weight class. It was tough to stop him because, you know, you had to get him stopped long enough to stop him. But like, he would just was a mover, score and move, score and move, and he was a local guy. He always got on the card, but he didn't really show the promise of being an elite K-1 fighter. Carter Williams showed that power. Carter Williams gets into a tournament. He gets, three victories in one night, culminated by a huge KO victory over Rick Rufus, who later in his career is still having success in kickboxing because he knew his left hand, he knew angles, he knew movement. He was still able to score in spots, and he was still better than most guys. Rick kept getting opportunities. He just couldn't beat the elite guys. So when Carter had the fight and he blew him out, K1's like, this is our guy. He's got this, you know, he's got fast twitch muscles. He's got the look. He's very, very strong. He had, you know, big, huge legs, huge arms. Like, he had the look of, this is going to be the guy. So Carter Williams, he gets the opportunity to fight Dewey Cooper after he had already earned him a spot in the elimination. Very controversial decision in his favor. I thought Dewey Cooper won that night the first time I watched it. Second time I watched it, I could see how they were kind of looking at Carter's power. But if you want to go off of points, I thought Dewey Cooper won that fight. The more I look at it, and I've kind of switched decisions here and there throughout the years, but that was an important fight for Carter Williams. Again, all these physical tools, some of this is your tools, the tools that you bring into it. And he's got, I'm telling you, the athleticism he had as a heavyweight. We've had guys with more success. I don't think we've had an athlete the level of Carter Williams on the kickboxing scene. So Carter gets that win. And then he goes on to the elimination that year, and then he loses to Ray Seffel. Wasn't the best fight in the world. I believe there was a cut, and Seffel advanced on a cut. I believe there was a head clash, and then they went to the cards. So then after that, you're like, all right, what's going to happen with Carter Williams? They gave him a super fight opportunity on the undercard against Bjorn Brege. And he has an awesome showing against Bjorn Brege. He's scoring good offense. He's scoring big-time low kicks. There was a moment where he got caught in the clinch, and Carter Williams got his head pulled down into a knee. But luckily for Carter Williams, his head hit more the leggy part, kind of more on the quad as opposed to the knee, and he was able to battle out of that. He was able to get the stoppage over Bjorn Brege in the next round. And again, Bjorn Brege at the time was a good kickboxer, but he's a monster of a man. So getting that win in Japan meant a lot. So he's walking out. I remember he's looking at the camera. He's like, I love you, Japan, and so on. Great smile, great power, great look. Carter Williams had the tools to be the guy. Then it didn't happen. Did not happen for him. He had a loss that he was winning a fight. I think it was the guy's last name was Rhett, I want to say. I can't remember exactly, but he's winning the whole fight. He takes a huge KO loss in that fight. And then Mighty Mo ended up emerging out of that tournament. Of all things, Mighty Mo with a big overhand right. Mighty Mo, also I'd say Mighty Mo, the Mighty Mo fight was the fight that really changed things around for Carter Williams. Because Carter Williams was winning the fight with Mighty Mo. And then he got tired, and then Mo scored it down, and then Mo just started throwing heat. Because everybody knows Mo's got that right hand. And Mighty Mo was able to get a victory over him. Mighty Mo goes on to the next tournament, and he fights Dewey Cooper. Dewey Cooper beats him with scoring and movement, and then he goes on to fight Michael McDonald, who won a good majority of the the North American-based tournaments. Michael McDonald out of Canada was able to represent America after that field. But that was the last time Carter Williams was ever thought of as, this is going to be a guy. So they put, you know, the fight, Rhett Wallace, I'm going to say his name is. They put the tournament together at the end of the year, hoping that Carter would earn it this time. But didn't happen. Then you heard that Carter got himself into some drug troubles and some alcohol troubles, got into some legal troubles, and it didn't happen. He's one of those guys that it didn't happen for. So despite that, as far as prospect goes, once upon a time, people thought Carter Williams was the guy. Kit Cope, as I mentioned before, Kit Cope trained out of Vegas. Vegas was one of the few places having consistent Muay Thai fights at the time. Kit Cope had developed a decent career. Developed a decent record, and then all of a sudden he gets the opportunity to fight Alex Gong in the early 2000s, you know, and I'm going to bring this name up again when I talk about the best guys that never were, the guys you never got the opportunity to hear about. Alex Gong would have been a regular fighting in K1, no question about it. No question about it. Tragedy brought about the end of his life, but at a very young age, despite the fact that he would have been older when he went, because I think Alex Gong was, in his early 30s, maybe even 30 years old when he passed away. But Kit Cope was this young, get-in-your-face brash guy. He had a good style for Muay Thai. He was a very tough kid. He would always come back at you with offense, but he had buzz around him. Not only did he have buzz in terms of this is the guy to watch, this is a guy who's entertaining, but he talked trash. He kind of got, you know, he was the kind of person where you're like, okay, he's got a lot of the factors that make you want to see him fight down the road. You know, a lot of the attributes, I should say, that make you think this kid, Kit Cope, is good and can sell himself. He started to get a little bit bigger, which means he was no longer due to the K1 Max division. But in the beginning, he was that size. And he goes against Alex Gong, and Alex Gong is deathly sick. He's clearly sick and shouldn't be fighting. So Alex Gong goes out there, and he tries to stop Kit Cope in the first round. So he is just absolutely smashing Kit Cope. He's landing everything in the world round one. Then he's done. You can see in the corner that that was his best effort to win the fight, was to try to go out there and win that stoppage. Kit Cope was not done. He was just getting started. The next four rounds are all Kit Cope. Clearly landed most significant offense, one with the boxing, one in the clinch, one with the kick game. Kit Cope looked like he had those tools. Kit Cope, between flirting with MMA, between some of those opportunities that he had to go to Thailand, because Kit Cope, of course, he also had buzz because the MTV did a, you know, true life of a Muay Thai fighter, and they followed him as he trained and he went over to Thailand, which didn't end up being Thailand. I think they fought like bare knuckles on like the Cambodian border or something like that, whatever. But he had buzz. So he had buzz and he had athletic tools. He's another guy where it didn't work out in the end. Those fights that some of those bare knuckle fights, whatever, against those guys who've been fighting, those guys aren't great. All right, and it's going to be real. Some of those guys ain't good. Sometimes you hear that people are fighting in those opportunities and they're getting wins. And it's all super cool. It's bare knuckle, whatever. Not all those guys are great. I'm not saying that the guy he went against was great or not great. I'm just saying that those guys, those fights, and my trips to Thailand, I've come to learn, those aren't necessarily the most skilled guys in the world. A lot of those guys, you see a lot of people take dives in those fights. They are not the guys to build your resume on necessarily. Not resume in terms of towards elite competition. They can build your resume in terms of getting in there and getting ring time, but they're not going to push you in that way. So Kit Cope had those opportunities, had those kind of championships. So if you see his resume, you know, you're going to see a lot of world titles and so on. But in his international opportunities, he had Kenichi Ogata, the shootboxing champion. Ogata got a victory over him, and he got Akiyomi Nida, and Nida got a head kick victory over Kit Cope. It didn't happen for Kit. So, again, MMA came into play for Kit, so other fight opportunities. I believe Kit even boxed, if I remember correctly. He'd opened a gym that he moved out to Los Angeles. Once you start opening a gym and you start focusing on other people it takes from you, all those things come into play. But Kit Cope had buzz as a guy who was going to be internationally something in America. It just didn't work out that way. Next fighter I'm going to talk about is Shane Campbell. Shane Campbell, I did an article on Shane Campbell, who's been in Muay Thai for a very long time, and he had a lot of success in Canada, and he had opportunities to go fight in China. Long frame, had growing all the time as a fighter. He had a good style that had kickboxing and low kicks in it. It had a lot of body kicks in his game. He definitely used his hands really well, wiry style, got a lot of international opportunities. I wrote that I thought I believe I wrote the article in 2010, that Kit Cope was the best fighter in North America. I really liked his skill set. I really thought that as I looked at everybody that we had, I said, this guy is the guy who could most have K1 success. Like, I thought that he had the tools. Now, I'm not saying other guys out there didn't have good resumes. I'm not saying other guys out there weren't good. I'm not saying that because he was my favorite guy that my second favorite guy is so far behind him. I'm just saying that Shane Campbell had the tools. He was long. He could box. He you know, very comedic guy. I've been around him before. Probably one of the funniest drunks I've ever been around in my entire life. I don't drink. But I worked the fight event in Edmonton, and he was there. And we were just hanging out afterwards, and this guy's just absolutely hilarious. But I thought that he had the tools to win on the international level. He dominated his home turf, which is very important. Alan Sylvester, of course, is the guy who got the opportunity to fight on the, what was it? Basically, what would be Contender Asia, which would be the Muay Thai version of Contender. That's where you would know of Alan Sylvester. He fought on that card. And he was a Canadian fighter before that. Shane Campbell beat him. Trevor Schmandisch, another guy who was a Canadian fighter who had success. Shane Campbell beat him. Shane Campbell beat the elite guys in his country. Very, very important. Now, again, he, you know, finished before some other guys like Johnsy came up kind of after that. So he didn't get that opportunity. He'd still love to see that fight happen one day. Shane Campbell, of course, now very committed to MMA. He fights in Canada, and he still had the career that I wanted, that I saw would happen as a kickboxer. He didn't have the K-1 max success like I thought was going to happen. He got into K-1. He got the opportunity to fight for them. It just didn't happen. Had a victory over Chris Ngimbe, of course, which is very important. Chris Ngimbe, of course, he had success in its showtime. Long time, very successful international fighter. Shane Campbell had an all right career. Got to go to China. He got to the semifinals, I want to say. I want to say he won two fights when he fought on the Infusion reality show. It was the season that Gago Drago won. He had a good run. Shane Campbell, tools. One of those guys that I heard about early, one of the prospects in this game. Going to keep bouncing around. I'm going to go back to the women's game. Erica was a girl who I fell in love with because at 16 years old, 16 or 17, I want to say it was 16 years old, they had an opponent for Rena, and the opponent for Rena fell out. So then they had this exhibition match between Erica and Rena. Erica had been in the game her whole life. She'd been in the gym for a while. She'd showed all the tools. Erica then drops Rena. I want to say she drops her twice in a one-round exhibition fight. And all of a sudden, all the buzz was about this girl, Erica. Erica is one of the few female fighters in the world that has legit KO pop. You hear it. You hear the term. You hear that someone's got this KO ability. It's not necessarily the case with a lot of female fighters. You hear that they got stoppages, but then if you watch those fights, it's usually because one athlete was better than the other athlete, or one athlete was good in the clinch and the other athlete wasn't. If you look at MMA stoppages in the female game, I would say 70% of them probably happen with knees in a clinch. And if you were to ask me how do I think these KOs happen for women, I'd say they most commonly happen with knees, more so than boxing. So when you hear about Erica, she's got a legitimate left hook and legitimate KO power. Victories over Little Tiger, Namawan, Sihee Ham. The Namawan victory is very good. She was very, very talented internationally. Tatiana van Plinen, she got that victory. That's a Dutch fighter. She stopped her. What we got? Kanaka Oka. Mia Yoshida. She's got... and then Sylvia Lanata, Italian woman. These are all legit victories, and all of these victories, and I know that all you guys know who Little Tiger is and who Namawan is because you don't follow female fighting as much, but I'm telling you, all these victories for Erica Kamimoru, they all happened when she was a teenager. She was 17, 18 years old getting all these big time victories. She was, I want to say she was 20 years old when she won the shoot boxing championship. She beat Sihee Ham in the final. And again, Sihee Ham got up early because of a judo throw. So she had to battle her way back. She scored down in the third round because of that KO pop. And then she kept bringing the heat all round. She was able to get the victory there. But she had the look. She was very, very talented. Unfortunately, she got some sort of illness. I forget what it was that caused her to end her career shortly. So I know that she's still at the gym. They say she trains all the time. She's still living healthy and so on. But whatever this illness is, I never got the specifics of it. It ended her career. But you could hear about her in the way that you hear about Rena. Rena, of course, was another young star who had a lot of potential. But Rena had some losses early on. Even though she won the championship, she lost to Lim Soo-jung. You know, she still had the look. Rena's very pretty, very talented. She had one of those early buzzes, so she'd kind of be like a side person for my list. The entire shootboxing women's brand was built on her, and she had success. She's got the KO power with the body rip. I'll go ahead and make her a side addition. Go ahead and give Rena some love. And Rena beat Erica when they met in their rematch. They had a 5-round rematch, very, very close. Slight edge went to Rena. Very, very big victory for her. But Erica, career that didn't turn out, but I'm telling you, very young age, you saw all the tools. Rena, still fighting on an international level, still getting international competition because they keep bringing it in for her. She will fight majority of her career in Japan because that's where she makes her money. I mean, she gets endorsements, she gets commercials, she's got a good look. You know, she went to Australia to train with a person who she beat twice in Christina Jerjovic. And with that opportunity, she worked on her English. She could be a star down the road. So I'll go ahead and add Rena to this list because, again, young star that turned out. She had some, like I said, some inconsistency there, but she always had the tools. We'll go ahead and go through this list further. Let's go ahead and go to Daniel Gita. Daniel Gita, again, we all know it's just common knowledge now. You look at Daniel Gita, KO pop with the left hook. That came later. When I first met Gita, Gita was pretty much a more athletic version of Paul Sawinski. Paul Sawinski was this guy who'd come out, hook low kick, somebody would throw a combination on him, he'd go low kick. Paul Sawinski had his whole career, he'd fight every 3 weeks, and he built his whole career on the idea that his low kicks was going to stop the other guys. And that's how he won most of his fights. Daniel Gita had a lot of athletic tools, but very, very similar. His boxing was sufficient, but he was a low kicker. And he came out of Romania, and Romania had some kickboxing stars, you know, kind of get on the scene. Catalin Marsanu, they had guys get opportunity. Raul Catanis, none of those guys are even close to the skill level of Daniel Gita. Not saying that in a three-minute, you know, three-round fight that they couldn't get a victory off Daniel Gita. I'm just saying Gita was special. If you look at the crowd, you look at his audience, you look at that following that he had, there was buzz to him. And that's a very, very important thing about this whole list. There is buzz to you before this happened. There was buzz to Rena. There was buzz to Erica. There was buzz to Liam Harrison. You heard about something's brewing in this part of the world about this athlete. So you really have to go look at what Daniel Gita meant in that regards. So early on, he had some interesting victories. Phillips was the American-based fighter from Germany who was a very good kickboxer. He had a K-1 opportunity. He didn't win it, but he had a K-1 opportunity. Daniel Gita got a victory over him. Daniel Gita got a victory over Freddie Camayo. Tony Gregory was the guy who actually beat Gita, and then he stopped Gita, and then they did the fight again, and then Gita stopped him back. Gita was something. And then all of a sudden, Gita gets this opportunity to fight on its Showtime against Thomas Rons. And Thomas, it's one of the victories where if you want to know what high-level kick countering is, watch the fight between Daniel Gita and Thomas Rahn. Thomas Rahn did a pretty good job of playing the low-kick game because Thomas Rahn never had that KO pop. But Gita had a little bit of KO pop, but he had a very, very good low-kick encounter, low-kick game. It's an excellent fight, and Daniel Gita is going to stop him with low-kicks in the second round. But you're going to see that's how the game is played. You're going to see it at a very high level, and it shows just how special Daniel Gita was. This guy was something. So Daniel Gita gets this opportunity. K1, there's all these rumors that it's not doing its well. It's not doing that many tournaments. It's not having as much success. And then you hear that they're putting together a qualification tournament in Japan. And I see Daniel Gita's names on the list. Sooner than I see it, I was like, here it is. Prophecy fulfilled. He's going to win this tournament. No doubt in my mind. No doubt in my mind that Daniel Gita was going to win it all. Daniel Gita gets in the tournament, wins all the fights by stoppage, low kick stoppage in two of the fights, and he scored a KO with his hands in one of the fights, if I remember correctly. Sergey Lysenko is another guy who kind of burst in the scene. He was a guy who he didn't have buzz in the same way. He had fought like 10 times in like 3 weeks. He was in a 1 week tournament like 2 weeks before the K1 event, and he just was a tough guy. But Gita put it to him all. Gita then, of course, went on to have success. Great fights with Gokhan Saki. Mean left hook. Very, very, very good fighter who had buzz coming out of Romania before he came what he became. Next fight I'm going to talk about is Chingiz Alazov. Chingiz Alazov, I have no idea why he's not signed to a major kickboxing organization. Somebody should be using him. Glory should be using him. He is such a talented, athletic kid who... he burst on the scene very, very young, and I remember the first time we really talked about him. I had Ryan Scalia. Ryan Scalia, now boxing writer. He wrote for Liver Kick back in the day, and we're talking about young prospects up and coming, and we're talking about people who we liked on the card. There was this promotion called Fight Code, one of many promotions to emerge after K1 Max had gone away. Fight Code was based on the idea that we got Georgia Petrosian, best fighter in the world, and we're going to put a tournament together, and let's see what happens with the tournament. Of course, what's going to happen with the tournament is we're going to bring in a whole bunch of guys who are not good enough to beat Daniel Gita. Not good enough to beat Georgia Petrosian, which, even if you did bring in being a guy good enough to beat Georgia Petrosian, he probably still wasn't going to beat Georgia Petrosian because Giorgio was the man. So it emerges. It uses both Giorgio and Armin Petrosian, and it had single fights every once in a while, and in the single outside of their tournament field. And in that tournament field, there was a kid named Chingiz Alazov, and he just had such athleticism and played with such violence from both stances. It was amazing. He was butchering guys. So his whole buzz was built on the idea that when he came in, you almost want to consider him to be like Goldberg in wrestling. You just brought this kid in, and he would just murder, death, kill whoever's in front of him. He just was an amazing, amazing fighter. You are going to see him eventually fight at the highest level. But to go back and find some of these Fight Code fights is a service well done to yourself if you can get a hold of them. Because I'm telling you, the violence comes from both hands. He's got KO pop in both hands, sneaky head kicks. He was able to get some good international victories down the road. He beat a guy who I love in the Alim Nabayev down the road. He's got there are names that are losing me. Campagna is another one. Alessio Campagna is another one. Victory off the top of my head. But he's still a young guy who has all these tools. But the Fight Code brand, it was a promotion. It very, very short-lived. It gave us the opportunity to see a young up-and-coming star on an international stage. So Chingiz Alazov, big-time fighter. Definitely check him out if you get the opportunity. We move on into the list. We're starting to head towards the biggest guys on my list, but I'm going to go ahead and mention a couple others. I'm going to go ahead and go with Pat Barry. Pat Barry. Of course, you guys all know it. You know Pat Barry. He is a guy who had some MMA fame. It didn't work out for him so much as far as long-term kickboxing success, simply because K1 ran into its troubles, and then he started dabbling in MMA and so on. But let me tell you, Pat Barry, when I first heard of Pat Barry, he was a guy who had won a tournament, and I want to say it was in Nebraska. And in this tournament, he came out. He beat a guy with low kicks. He went to an extra round decision with another guy, and then he beat another guy with head kicks. That one-night tournament pretty much describes Pat Barry's career to a T. Either Pat Barry had such explosion. He has huge legs. He has one of the meanest low-kick whips in the history of kickboxing. He has a sneaky fast head kick from both stance, but particularly his left head kick is very, very high and vicious. He has KO pop in both hands. His destruction of Gary Goodridge in K1 is one of the meaner KOs you're ever going to see. That it is freaking mean. And it shows off the big low kick. That fight shows off all of his tools in like one moment. Pat has all these tools. When I trained with Ernesto Hoost, we had talked about Pat Barry. Ernesto Hoost said Pat Barry had all the tools to be one of he should be one of the top four fighters in K1 right now. Because K1 was still going at the time when I trained with him. I trained with him in 2010. I met him in Jamaica, and then we worked with each other that week while I was going into the Champions versus Champion event. But we were talking about him, and he said, man, Pat's got all the tools. So he was a guy who had buzz thanks to this tournament because, again, Carter Williams had just not had been what we thought. So enter Pat Barry. It's not that Pat Barry was young, but Pat Barry did have buzz, and that's important. So he went out, he trained with Duke Rufus a couple times. Duke Rufus was trying to get him fight opportunities, ended up getting him kickboxing opportunities and getting him into the UFC. Shout out to Duke Rufus. But Pat had all the tools. Pat loved this sport so much that first he started off in Louisiana, and he did, and a lot of us kickboxers did it. Inner squads are what they call them in some parts of the world. But basically, he just looked to fight wherever. So sometimes gyms would get together and pretty much sanction their own fights. Didn't have a lot of, you know, sanctioning bodies, but he would just keep fighting wherever he could. He went out to China, fought wherever he could out in China. He just kept pursuing it full. He loved kickboxing and pursued it full. I remember talking to him after one of his MMA fights, and he had lost to LeVar Johnson, I want to say his name was. And he said, I don't love it. He said, I like that I get paid well in MMA. He said, but I don't love the sport necessarily. But I do like that it's brought me more money than I could ever imagine. And I look at that and I go, hey, good for you. Good that you're making your due. You're able to make money. But in the beginning, he pursued this kickboxing thing as full as he possibly could. He had every physical tool. In the end, he struggled with consistency. You know, just he'd have a win here, and then he'd lose to Freddie Camejo. He'd be winning. He'd be beating Freddie Camejo. And then Freddie Camejo got a knee cut him that ended the fight. Got a victory over, was it Nordstrom? Yes, it was a victory over Nordstrom. And then he'd lose to, like, a Scott Lighty type. Like, just, it was just the consistency. Or maybe he beat Lighty. I can't remember that correctly. I think Lighty got a victory over him. But in his losses, it'd be due to kind of like inactivity. Like fights that I for sure thought that, oh man, Pat's going to win this one. Pat's going to win this one. And then all of a sudden, after some explosion, he'd move around and you wouldn't see the offense as much. So very, very weird guy. As far as the consistency part goes, but I'm telling you, as far as athletic skill goes, Pat Barry is one of the best athletes to ever kickbox. Like, I'm telling you, running, jumping, he was a super athlete. Big time low kick, big time body kick, big time head kick, big time KO in both hands, KO power in both hands. He was a talent, and that's what this list is about. It's about guys who were prospects where you're like, man, this could be it. Next person I'm going to talk about as I go through this list, I'm trying to save my last ones because you guys all know the last ones, but I want to save them. I'm going to talk about two young guys who are, you know, doing work on the scene right now as we speak. Ilias Belaid and Muhammad Jiraiya, both birth of the Infusion kickboxing brand. So Infusion is a Dutch-based brand who is now making their way internationally. And they're pretty much running the way a kickboxing organization called It's Showtime ran its business. It's Showtime. It does not no longer exist anymore, but is run by Simon Roots. And Simon Roots, he had his kickboxing brand, and he was a management team. And that management team had all the best guys in K1. So Glory, if you want to know how Glory started because its ownership group couldn't buy K1, and it was too difficult because K1 had all these old debts and stuff like that, whatever. So all they did was they went and bought Simon Roots' management company, and that gave them Simon Roots' promotion, and it gave them Simon Roots' fighter list. It gave him all his fighters on his resume. So when that came about, It's Showtime at the time had been this brand where it was Dutch based. It had big time kickboxers and big time opportunities in Holland, but then it would move to someplace like France, and then the whole card would be undercard, and part of the main card would be French fighters versus the It's Showtime main fighters. There'd be some fights where those French fighters would win. There'd be a lot of fights where those French fighters would lose. But, like, that's how it was done. So you had – that was how those cards were put together. It's Showtime would go to an international place. They would co-promote with a local promoter. And between the two of them, they would get local audience and international audience, and they'd put on these shows. Infusion works like that. They have their stars, like Iman Barlow, who I'm going to talk about in a little bit. And they've got, like – they will travel from a – Holland, and they'll go to England, or they'll go to Scotland, or they'll go to Ireland, or they'll go to, you know, wherever, and the whole card will be their, some of their stars getting international opportunities against the best fighter from that area, and then the whole undercard would be matched up with guys who were well-matched fighters for the local brand, so it's run the same way. While they were doing this, they decided to put the show together, a show called Rookies, and the Rookie Show is based on giving young fighters an opportunity to compete. In Holland, as you can imagine, there are fighters, kids who have been fighting, like, you could fight every weekend if you want to in Holland, you know, when I was there, and that was in 2011, you know, so it's like, they have a lot of fight opportunities, because, as Ernesto Hu said it, there is a, like, 100 gyms you can get from one side of Holland to the other in 3.5 hours of driving. And there's like 100 gyms in, you know, just a small area. So that means they can compete and they can develop fighters all the time. Young Moroccan kids are starting to grow up and have young Moroccan heroes in the sport. And they're starting to go into kickboxing because there's a huge Moroccan community in Holland. Two of those Moroccan kids are Muhammad Jiraiya and Ilias Belaid. These kids build resumes and they got the opportunity to fight on the Rookie Show very early on. they have become stars. Muhammad Jiraiya has mean KO pop in both hands. He can score KOs with his feet as well, as far as the shooters with the low kick game, the kick game. He's got good style. Ilias Blade has got work rate like no other. It's crazy because both Muhammad Jiraiya and Ilias Blade are birth of a new style of pad holding. So basically, there is a guy named Lucien Corbin. And if you watch Lucien Corbin work on the mitts, he's just masterful. He just plays with new combinations, and he just, you know, as he said in my documentary, like, his students ask, where do you come up with this? He said, I don't know. He says he thinks fighting all the time. So he comes up with these crazy combinations that you wouldn't even imagine. They just come together in his mind. And as he did this, as he put this life together and he put these combinations together, he started to put chain combinations together in his pad holding. If you see it over in America, some people would say, you know, you're not going to fight like that. You're never going to fight like that. Why would you punch that many times? Why would you throw that many combinations? Enter Muhammad Jiraiya and Ilias Blade. They grew up on that type of pad holding. So they grew up with the understanding of this is how you win fights with this kind of volume. So they will give you the exact same long 8-shot combinations that you would see on these pad holding series. Birth of Lucien Corbin, became famous to a lot of gyms in Holland, and these guys fight like that pad holding style. So when you watch Muhammad Jiraiya, when you watch Ilias Blade, you are going to see some of the best technique you'll ever see in your life, and you're going to see some of the longest chain combinations you've ever seen. Their volume is just unbelievable. Ilias Blade, of course, having K1 success now, he got to the K1 finals. He's one of the best 65 kg fighters in the world. He has, fought with, he lost to Masaki Nori, but he still has victories, a KO victory over Chris Pissarro. He is a star. Muhammad Jiraiya, of course, was on the fight of the year so far this year, earlier for the Showtime brand against Ben Mo. Just a very, very talented guy. These young guys still, we're talking about guys who are, I think Jiraiya's 19, 20, and then I think Ilias Blade's 21. So we're still talking about young guys. The future of the game today, even today, we're producing these prospects for the sport down the road. There's a slight glitch there. I'm not sure if you guys noticed it, but we're back on track. We're back to the podcast show. Next person I want to talk about on my list, and I'm going to go ahead and go to Nathan Carnage Corbett. And let me tell you something about Nathan Corbett. Again, Nathan, of course, his legacy will always be he was the best guy in a weight class that didn't really have a lot of guys. Nathan Carnage Corbett came on the scene in Australia. He was this guy who I heard his frame filled out more as he over the days. But I'm telling you, he is known to have KO pop. And he seemed to be the best guy with elbows on the international scene. Outside of Thailand, to this very day, if you were to say Stephen Wright, who is the best with elbows that you've ever seen? And it would be a clear, without question, Nathan Corbett. That's my answer. Of all the fighters in the world, all the legends, Danny Bills, Jeremy Pars, everybody, every country that I could possibly think of. I'm not saying that these guys weren't great, I'm not saying that they didn't have good careers, Raymond Dekkers, all these guys, all good fighters. When it comes to the ability to land elbows consistently, elbows that stop fights, whether through cuts or whether through damage, Nathan Carnage Corbett was the guy. So when I first heard about him, I was told that there was this guy who was getting all these KOs, and he had some of the meanest elbows ever. And I looked at him resume-wise, and he was always judged in one way. Will Nathan Carnage Corbett move up to fight at heavyweight? Because that's what everybody did. Let's talk about the big fight that he had with Tyrone Spong, for example. That both happened when they were established later in their careers. But the whole thing about that that was interesting was Tyrone was way smaller than Nathan when he first started. When he first did this, he was a smaller guy. Whereas Nathan, he had always been around that 86, I think he said was his best weight class. So he'd always fought around 86 to 90 kgs when he started to get a little bit better. But I think 86, I remember him, campaigning at kind of about 82.5 around there. But that was his weight class that he felt. He felt like he was the best around there, full rules tie. The only problem was he didn't have anybody. He did not have a lot of people to compete with. And I look at that era and I go, okay, Clifton Brown came, but Clifton Brown had wins and losses. You know, throughout his career, he had some great moments and some bad moments, but he was a guy who developed a name, and that was good for Nathan to get on his resume, because the elbow that Nathan landed on Clifton Brown, it's one of those violent things you're ever going to see. Like that first, the first fight, he stopped him the second fight as well, but the first fight, go ahead, Google Nathan Corbett, or YouTube Nathan Corbett, N-A-T-H-A-N, just Nathan Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, against Clifton Brown, C-L-I-F-T-O-N-B-R-O-W-N. Go ahead, look at that first fight. Look at the first fight between those two. It's one of the most vicious elbows you're ever going to see. So he had that, and he had Magomedov was a guy who campaigned, and he did have some bigger fights at bigger weights and so on, but those two were it for that weight class for him. He didn't have anybody. He got a couple of K-1 opportunities, but against smaller guys. Tatsufumi Tomohiro is the guy who came through and so on, whatever. But the thing that made Nathan Corbett legit, the thing that legitimized his career more than anything, was he was in a K-1 tournament in Scandinavia. And again, he was all Muay Thai before that. Maybe a kickboxing here and there, but his resume was Muay Thai. So when he went against Steve McKinnon, that was the other guy of note later in his career. He was established by then. But in that tournament, you know, victories over Moxitage. Ashwin Balrock was the guy who he met in the K-1 final there. He showed great kickboxing, and he was a guy who, again, he had good boxing, he had a strong low kick game, but really he had the elbows. So he was another one of those guys where you heard about him, and then as YouTube started to emerge more, that's one of the fun things about doing this. This whole list came together for me when I first got in the fight forums. We had Mega Upload. Now, the guy who runs Mega Uploads in prison somewhere, and, you know, his house was confiscated and all that other kind of stuff, whatever. Now, everything's on YouTube. We used to hate YouTube videos, you know, like, we wanted people to put up content that we could download and put on our computer. So, I have, like, hours and hours of, like, footage of grainy, because, you know, the HD hadn't really, you know, been as, you know, popular around that time. So I've got a lot of footage of just old Nathan Corbett back in the day, of all these old fighters. That's how we got footage back then. So when Nathan burst on the scene, it was tough for me to get some of his fights, because they were played on Fox in Australia. And they are played on delay. So sometimes these fights would happen, and then they would emerge 3 weeks later. Luckily for us, people, you know, started to bring in camcorders, because we didn't have video on our phones yet, which just shows the nature of what I'm doing with this podcast. We didn't have video on our phones yet. So then if you got something early, it's because somebody literally came in with a video, recorder to make it happen. So Nathan came up around that period of time, and then fights like the Clifton Brown, because it's shorter, that kind of stuff emerged. And then he got the tournament down the road when he was already established. So Nathan Carnage Corbett, again, another one of those guys who had buzz and then emerged into something else. We are winding down the list. I am going to go ahead and go with the most prominent female fighter as far as buzz goes, and of course I've talked about her many times. I, you know, call her my daughter on the show. Iman Barlow has got one of the most interesting stories in all of kickfighting period. Iman Barlow has been in the sport legitimately since she was 4 years old. Now you hear that and you think you're overreacting, Steven, you're making it up. If there were video cameras on Iman Barlow, you know, there's that famous Russian girl who's like, I believe she's from Russia, but like she, it shows her dad on the mitts, like her dad kind of does it with his hands, and he teaches her counterfighting, and it shows her shadowing, and it shows her punching trees. Because we've got video now, we can see the progression of that girl as she grows up and goes into combat sports. So really famous, and Dana White, he posts on her all the time, and like people pay attention to this young girl at this very young age. If they had video when Iman Barlow was growing up, that's the kind of stuff that you would have seen. You would have seen her putting in work on the pads throughout her whole life. Her family, her mom, who was 3 times British champion, fought Lucia Riker back in the day. For your gene pool to first come from my mom fought, that's already unique in itself. But Iman Barlow then went from that to growing up in a sport, the girl who beats the boys. That's what she was called in a lot of the newspapers there in Melton Mowbray. That's where she's from in England. And she had fought in Thailand. So basically what her family would do is they live in England for half of the year, and then they go to Thailand for like 3 or 4 months, and then they come back. So every time over the Queen's Cup, she'd always go down. So she competed in it her whole life. She didn't stop fighting boys until one age she got, and they were like, okay, she's, you know, physically, she's like, then finally we got to 13, and the boys start to get bigger and better. Like, when we were kids, we were just kids. It was nothing, she said. Then the boys got stronger. See my documentary, Shin on Shin, if you want to know more about this story. But anyways, she had this buzz in England from the guys that just – because it happened on just happenstance. She's trained at Jitty Gym, which is where the guys at Bad Company trained. So I first heard about her. I just got on Facebook. Go ahead. Shows how old I am. I just got on Facebook at the time. In college, I was like, swore I would never do it. And then I got on. I started traveling internationally. I go, how am I going to keep a hold of my friends when I travel? And I go, okay, I've got to get on this Facebook thing. I got on Facebook, and I started to follow people that I knew. And I followed Liam Harrison. And then I saw a picture of him at Jitty Gym, and I saw a picture of Iman. At the time, she must have been 15 years old. So then I went ahead, clicked, and introduced myself and said, hey, who, you know, how are you, and that kind of stuff. And then I asked her about her resume. And then she sent me that she had more than 140 fights at 15 years old because she just kept going to Thailand, and she fought all she could, and sometimes with shin guards and sometimes without. So she was the first time I had ever heard of any man, woman, or child to have a resume like that that wasn't Thai-born. Later, I started to meet a lot of Dutch guys like Jirai and Elise Blade. They all had super resumes too in their teens. But like that was the first time that I had been experienced or introduced to it. So then she started to get these fight opportunities. She had this gap where she kind of was like done with fighting, and then she started to go into, like, as she said, you know, partying and doing stuff that athletes aren't supposed to do. And then she turned her career around. She like put on some weight. She got rid of all the weight, and she fell in love with the sport. At that time, the infusion brand that I mentioned before, it started to leave England and go to different places. One of the places that it went to was England, and they did show several shows there. And one of the stars that they focused on, because one of their commentators is Vinnie Shorman, him and Kieran Kettles, who works matchmaking for them in England, they got together, and they also helped with co-promoting, and they started their own management team. They had known about Iman, and Iman at this time is still fighting. She fights at her home. She does like a charity event that gives her opportunity to fight at home once a year, and then she'd just been traveling and building resumes. So if you look at her, she beat all the elite in her country, and then all of a sudden she gets this opportunity. They go, you're going to be the fighter that we push. She beats Alexis Rufus, and then she goes on to be one of the best fighters in the world, my number two fighter in the world in the female division. Anissa Mexen is the best fighter in the world for me because they met, and Anissa Mexen got a stoppage victory over her. But Anissa Mexen's older. She didn't have the buzz that you had around Iman. Iman had buzz. People saying, this is going to be the girl. And to hear her entrance and to see the crowd respond to her, it truly, truly is special. So Iman Barlow is on this list. Is probably the most hyped woman that I could think of in the kickboxing sport. Her Jemima's up there too, but Iman Barlow, between kickboxing and Muay Thai, she was sought as the it girl long, long ago. Mike Zambides is an outside looking in sort of guy. I'm going to go ahead and mention him. It's just because his resume and wasn't as big or isn't as known of when he fought in Greece. He really made his name because there's a huge, huge Greek community in Australia. I wouldn't be surprised if there's more Greek people in Australia than there is in Greece. But because of that, promoters would bring him down, and he had a huge following. So early on, he'd go out there, and he was still – Mike Zambides, he was the last great kickboxer. Now, what I mean by that is this. There used to be an era of 10-round fights for kickboxing where they fight 2 minutes, didn't have clinch. It was just boxing with kicks, low kicks, head kicks, and so on. In that era, Mike Zambides was the best kickboxer in the world. K1 rules came later, you know, and they had a little bit of clinch and so on, whatever. But in just straight kickboxing, Mike Zambides was the last great of that. And he came up, he's 15 years old when he took his first pro fight. There was a guy who was 32 years old. That guy lost his opponent. They asked Mike if he wanted to do it. On short notice, he got in there and he won by KO. That was that got the story started. Mike Zambides was not tall enough to be successful in this sport. But he had great timing. He had natural power. He could generate his hips and his wild swing so well. And when he put his combination flurries together, he could get you. He had an explosion about him. He's got KOs with jumping knees and jumping kicks. He's just an exceptional. When you look at him and you say, how do I make the perfect kickboxer? You would look at Mike Zambides without watching him fight and say, it's not him. And then the moment you watched him fight, you'd be like, he'd be able to generate power like this guy. Mike Zambides is probably the premier KO fighter of the smaller weight classes. Special, special there. I was torn on putting him on the list, but I've already said his name out loud, so he's on the list. Mike Zambides, another one of those guys who, again, the buzz didn't happen in Greece as much. The buzz happened in Australia. This guy is special. This guy needs to be in K1. And then, of course, he gets the K1 opportunity against Albert Krauss, and he blows him out with a big overhand KO in the second round. Went on to have a very successful career. Again, Mike Zambides is a legend, but his career is not as good as the other people of his era. Not even close. Didn't beat Masato. Lost to Kohiramaki. Lost to Bukau. Lost to KO by Andy Sauer. He lost to a lot of elite guys. He's a legend because he was able to get crazy stoppages, and he was the last great 10-round kickboxer. Very, very important that I bring that up. So, going to go ahead and move on throughout the list. Most of them are off the list, so we're starting to get to the main elite guys here, that names that you wouldn't know of. And I will go to the last person that you probably are surprised is on this list, but at the time, it was a big deal. Huerto Teixeira, also known as Monster. Teixeira is the last Kyokushin guy to really get notability in K1. He was still winning tournaments in Kyokushin. Kyokushin is a karate art that has punches to the body. So you'll see a lot of body shots, a lot of punch chests, or punches to the chest and so on. And you can kick and knee anywhere. So you can low kick, head kick. So really, if you watch the matches, it is an exchange of combinations between punches and kicks. But it's like a fluid. Like, you ever watch a cardio class, or have you ever watched the end of a boxing class, sometimes they just put volume on the person and they make them throw a lot of 1-2s as fast as they can. This pace of a Kyokushin match, there's not really a lot of feeling out. After they get into the flow of it, there's a lot of offensive scores to the chest and then the low kick. So they've got great low kick endurance. They've got great shins because they check and return and check and return. And they've got some of the coolest KOs you're ever going to see in your life. Spinning hook kicks, jumping kicks, that kind of stuff, whatever. The first product of that, as far as K1 goes, Satake did it a little bit, but I would say Andy Hoog was the first big Kyokushin star. And he had been K1 champion, he had been developing a name for himself, he had been moving on. And then Francesco Filho, of course, I mentioned him before as one of the guys who did their version of the Kumite, the 100 guys you beat in 3-minute rounds, and you beat them in all one day, if I'm remembering that correctly. And then Glabe Fitoza. Those were the three guys who had already fought in K1, had success, had crazy KOs, had very good victories. They were the Kyokushin stars. The last great star of that era would be Huerto Teixeira. Teixeira, of course, known for having some bad KO losses, lost to Peter Arts, bad KO loss to Alistair Overeem. Teixeira didn't be what we thought he was going to be. But Monster, let me tell you something. He had the dreads, the big thick dreads. He was known. Like, people knew of him. There was buzz there. This was the last Kyokushin guy. Since then, I don't know. I have not heard of one Kyokushin guy who is competing on kickboxing on a high level. And this is what I do. But he was the last great star of that era. So I needed to make sure that I took the time to say, when I talk about this list, he's another one of those guys who it didn't work out for him. He got some wins, but he didn't become a star. But it's got to be known that 100% this guy was a buzzed athlete who was the last great Kyokushin guy to go into elite kickboxing. Will there be others? I'm sure somebody will emerge. And I'm sure there's some name that I maybe missed. But as far as the heavyweight division goes, it goes Hoog, Filho, Glabe, Monster. That's the route. So definitely check him out. Go ahead and wrap it up. Masato Kobayashi, there goes a name that you should have expected here. K1 Max was birthed on Masato, clear. Masato was this young guy who had all the tools. He had the boxing style. He could really score real well with the boxing, and he had the low kicks. And in his early days fighting in Japan, he had a loss to Kohiramaki. Like a second fight, I want to say, got a KO stoppage loss. We don't go hold that too much against people in kickboxing if you can develop consistency afterwards. But Masato's getting these international opportunities to fight. And early on, people were like, there's something about this kid. There's a documentary on him before he fought in the Max. There was buzz. And then documentary about him, another one that I know of, right when he got into K1 Max. People knew about this guy. There was something different about this guy. Had the look, as I mentioned before. The girls loved him. He had the attitude. He had this, I remember his manager said, I try to promote him as rebellious hero. You know, like there's this something that he wanted young people to appeal to. And Masato was it. He was the it factor with it. So Masato comes out there and he can score effective offense. He's got a good low kick whip. He's got boxing. He could score KOs. He was so well known in the small ranks that K1 decided that we're going to start having fights with smaller division guys again. K1 had flirted with it before with K2 and K3. They decided to bring him in. They gave him fights with, I believe, Melchor Menor was one of the guys. But his early fight success, Muhammad Ali, a guy who's fought in Holland, some of the best guys. Murat Sari, another guy, I believe he's French, who he got a victory off of. Masato had resume, he had buzz, and they put together the first K1 Max under the idea that K1 or that Japan might have the best kickboxer in the world. That's where the Max came together. That's why Masato was the backbone behind it. Of course, he was upset by Albert Krauser there, but he was something special in the beginning. Masato, one of the elite prospects who actually turned out to be a superstar. He became an all-time great, two-time K1 World Grand Prix champion. Victories over everybody that you could think of, except for Petrosian, because that fight didn't end up happening. Very, very special fighter. Just awesome, awesome Masato. We move on the list. We go into the big three. We are going to go with a guy who didn't turn out to be. Badr Hari in the line of great kickboxers in Holland. We go Artuk, so on. There was buzz about athletes who was going to be the next big star. I mentioned to you guys before that Bonjowski became a great star, but he didn't have big buzz. He was saw as, after he won that tournament in America, people were like, this is going to be the next champion from Holland. But he needed to win that tournament. He didn't have buzz. Badr Hari had buzz. He was a guy who everybody was talking about. Like, he was getting these KOs. He's fighting the heavyweight division. He probably was about 80 kgs when he first started, when I first heard about him. He was a wiry guy, wasn't big at all, but he had the volume. He had good offensive style, and he could get you out of there. Like, he could KO guys who were much bigger and stronger than him, wiry frame, but he could find the mark. He was at several gyms. He was at Musa's gym. He was at Chikoriki gym. He was at Mike's gym. He had moved around trying to find his niche for a while. But no matter where he went, people knew this is Badr's the next guy. Badr is the guy. And I was there when he had his comeback fight in France when he went against Tony Gregory. I cannot tell you enough that he was the first guy since my experience at the K1 World Grand Prix where I felt like he was a superstar. Like, he literally had that kind of buzz, despite he had been away from the sport for like a year and a half because of the Hezdi Hegis thing when he hit him on the ground. He really did have a very, very strong following. Like, KOs, he was known for a little small documentary on him. Thought he was going to be on K1 before he got there. I can't remember what it was called. It was like Muay Thai Mag or Max Mag or something like that .com. But they used to post fights. They used to have interviews. And they did an interview with him when he was 19 years old. And that's when you get to see him. He's brash. You get to hear the trash talking. And he goes, oh, by the time, 5 years from now, by the time I'm 24, I would have already won two K1 World Grand Prix. Easy. You know what I'm saying? Like, he had this, the buzz. He had the attitude. He talked trash. The press conference fights, of course, that he had with Peter Graham. The KO loss and then KO victory over Stefan Leko, he had it. Then his body grew into what he was expected to be, big muscular guy. Once upon a time, he lost to Alexei Ignashev by a body shot. The next time they fought, he was the stronger guy in the battle. You know, it just completely different guy. Badr Hari, a legit 6'6". You have no idea how tall Badr Hari is until you're standing next to him. He's a monster. He's a huge guy. So you go legit 6'6", KO power in both hands, KL Power with his kicks. I was rewatching a fight with him and Remy Bojowski the other day, and they're kind of showing like the VR going into the fight, and I go, man, Badahari got a lot of knockouts in K1, a lot of knockouts. He really did accomplish what he was supposed to be in terms of becoming a superstar. He was never the best kickboxer in the planet. I'd say the closest I'd give it to him was he beat Sebi Schilt, and that's very, very important. So I'd say I give him that, and that secured him as the people's champion. But I think that he was always considered one of the best, but he was never the best. But he was always up there. Talent-wise, still, fast twitch, KO power. There are some fights where he's so technically smooth. He was an unbelievable fighter. So Badahari is on my list as one of the elite prospects, because Badahari was the best prospect in kickboxing since Alexei Ignashov, which is the next guy I'm going to talk about. Alexei Ignashov, the Russian fighter, or the Belarusian Russian fighter, Alexei had every tool. First of all, he fought full rules Muay Thai. So he had victories early in his career against guys like Jorgen Kruth in full rules Muay Thai. But Alexei Ignashov is a guy who a lot of people didn't know until he fought Rob Kamen in his retirement fight. Everybody thought that he beat Rob Kamen, if you look at it score-wise, but it was in Rob Kamen's hometown, it was his last fight, and Rob had some moments where he'd throw like some offense, but the consistent offense came from Alexei Ignashov. After the fight was over with, Alexei Ignashov got the victory. Rob Kamen then went over and rewarded Alexei Ignashov the win in that fight, gave him the trophy, said you were the real winner. It was a real cool moment. Alexei Ignashov had KO pop. He had won a Grand Prix in Belarus. It was a regional tournament. I mentioned to you guys many times on the show before. K1, kickboxing, we used to have a map. Ignashov needed to win the Belarus Grand Prix, which he won all three fights by stoppage, like crazy big-time KO stoppages. Maybe one of them went to a decision, but I'm pretty sure there were stoppages in all three. He then went on to win the European Grand Prix in France. He then went on to win an elimination fight. He then went on to the K1 World Grand Prix. That was our map back in the day. That's how you got to the highest level. Regional got you to European. European got you to elimination. Elimination got you to K1 World Grand Prix. He was birthed of that, and he came from a gym that had other athletes. Vitaly Akramenko is a very talented guy who was a smaller weight guy who moved up in weight to heavyweight to have some success as well. Didn't win against elite guys, but had a lot of cool wins. Vitaly Akramenko, Alexei Ignashov had beat Henry Hooft, had beat Mark DeWitt, beat Lloyd Van Dams. He had resume. He had KO pop, and he had very good victories over guys well before he fought at the K1 level. And then he got a big victory over Peter Arts, and people thought this kid was legit. Between whether you heard it was alcoholism or whether you heard it was him fooling around with girls too much, didn't work out for Alexei Ignashov. But as far as tools go, legit 6'5", legit KO power in both hands. His fight with Mike Bernardo, one of the cleanest, most technical fights you're ever going to see. How rare is it that you see someone land a right hand to KO somebody and then low kick them afterwards, and then they go down from the low kick, still knocked out from the shot to the hand. It's from the right hand. Rewatch the fight, Mike Bernardo versus Alexei Ignashov. It is as clean a kickboxing as you're going to see. Steady, patient. If you've got a tall fighter, it's how you teach them to work. It's how you... Ignashov had a legit jab, a mean jab, just snapping it all over the place. Alexei Ignashov had all the tools, didn't become great, did not become great, didn't get anywhere close to where Badahari went. Still, young guy, great smile, great look, great fighter early in his career, didn't become the K1 World Grand Prix champion like we all thought, but still, Alexei Ignashov was very, very special. Giorgio Petrosian, you still would have had to have been a nerd to know who Giorgio Petrosian is. You would have had to really know. He had buzz, but his buzz came because there was a kickboxing organization called Super League. Super League, at the very end of it, still were, you know, on their website, which doesn't exist anymore. I remember the sad day that I went to it and I saw that it was no longer there. But Super League once had a rankings list. And one day, I'd go check the list, and then YouTube was starting to get bigger. So I'd check the list, and I'd go online to see if I could find some of the fighters. Lo and behold, there's a guy named Georgia Petrosian who ends up on the list. Georgia Petrosian never fought for Super League, but he ended up on the list because it looked like he was going to be a guy that they were going to use because they were going to go to that market. Super League was known to have good smaller weight guys, but they also had the in-between of weight classes up to heavyweight. Not heavyweight, but I think they went as high as 80 kgs. But they covered a lot of ground that the heavyweights didn't have. I want to say they went as high as 86 kgs. So they covered a lot. Anybody over 86, they made themselves a heavyweight. They fought in K1. So Petrosian, that was the first time I saw his name. He had victories early in his life over Shimshi Bakiri, Cedric Buller, Marco Piquet, Fabio Pinca, Abdullah Mabel, which he beat like three times. This was all before some of the Mabel fights were after. All before the fight that made him famous. The fight that made Georgia Petrosian famous was a draw that he had with Bukau. In that fight, when I first watched it, I thought Bukau won the first four rounds. Very close, but I thought he won the first four rounds. And I thought Petrosian won the last round. Better footage, better footage emerged. My first time I saw the video, I saw it from somebody who recorded it off a camcorder. Later, I saw the actual official fight. There is debate to it. I understand it being a draw. But at the time, it was unheard of because Bukau did not lose to guys who didn't fight in K1. That was impossible. And Georgia Petrosian, despite his buzz, he was a guy who was not in K1 yet. He then went from that one to have a victory over Arslan Magomedov, who I do believe fought Albert Krauss in K1 Max. He beat Norpol from the Contender Asia, beat him in Italy. He had Kim Sitsan Pinong, he beat him. He had a great resume of guys before he was a consistent fighter in K1. And then he had a fight on It's Showtime, and that, I think he went against Krista Gibby that night. And the guys from K1 were there. And then they were like, they were really impressed by Shahid Alhaj, and they were really impressed by the Italian kid. And that was him. So he's Armenian-based. They moved to Italy. Doesn't speak a lot of English. Like when I tried to interview him, his coach was able to do some. When I was doing the documentary, Petrosian would just kind of sit there. He'd answer in French or in Italian, and then somebody would interpret for him. But he became it. He had buzz. He got into this fight, and after this fight, everybody knew who he was. It was a non-K1 fight, and then they started to pay attention to his resume a little bit more. Turns out he's an all-time great now. You know what I'm saying? He turned into it, 2K1 World Grand Prix champions, one of the elite resumes in all of kickboxing ever. Georgia Petrosian, legit. We now wrap the show up on the guy who had the most buzz of probably anybody that I've ever known as far as kickboxing goes. We finish our show on Tyrone Spong. Tyrone Spong, of course, you heard the story. Tyrone Spong was the guy who, if you watch his documentary, he was just leaving school one day and he saw a friend go into a kickboxing gym and he knew the kid from school. So he asked the kid about it. The kid said, "I go to kickboxing." And he goes, "Hey, I'm a better athlete than this kid. I'm going to go." He goes into Lucien Corbin's gym, Fight Factory, and he said he got beat up really, really bad there. It's cultural. You go into a new gym, it's just like some of the boxing gyms in America back in the day, like Krunk Gym. New person shows up, they're like, fresh meat, you know what I'm saying? Like somebody new to hit, somebody inexperienced. Let's go get that guy. Let's go prove the worth of our gym. He went in there and he had a tough time, but it motivated him to go back in there. Some people get that tough time and they never go back. He was born to be a fighter from jump. Goes in, dives into it right away. Like gets a lot of fights, a lot of early opportunities. Gets to fight in Japan at like 17, 16 years old. He fought shootboxing. But then he starts to build the resume, and then he becomes the it guy. He's the guy that's too big for the max, but way too small for heavyweight. But he was the first guy where you're like, and again, all this is why he's like 18, 19, 20 years old. He's already a world champion with like 80 fights at the time. Artur Kashinko, as I mentioned before, that tournament he had gave him the opportunity to move into the K1. Tyrone Spong didn't have such a tournament because he was bigger than the weight class needed. So what he had to do was dominate his weight class and then continue to move up the rankings. So after, you know, beating, Yuri Mess, Yunus Almasani, I think they fought to a draw, William Deedner, Muhammad Ali, as I mentioned before, after starting to develop resume against those kind of guys, Dmitry Shikuta, like, he beat everybody. He was the man at 77 to 78 kgs. Outside of a one time, he had a mental lapse loss where he's winning the whole fight, and then he ended up getting stopped because he started, you know, playing around and not going for the kill, and he just got hit with a random shot. After that fight, everybody was like, okay, that's proof that anything could happen in a fight because he was murdering the guy. But, like, since that moment, he was committed to being a heavyweight after he beat Yuri Mess. So he slowly moved up. I talked about the Dmitry Shikuta fight. Dmitry Shikuta was one of the best fighters in the world, had a great resume in Super League, moved up from that weight class. Then he goes against Andre Hutnik, who hadn't lost in, like, he had won like 30 fights in a row before he fought Tyrone. Tyrone blew him out, and then Andre Hutnik went on another three-year winning streak, which just shows how good he is and showed how great Tyrone was. Then Tyrone gets up and wait. He goes against Azim Maksutaj to be his first K-1 fight. I was there for it. It was at the It's Showtime K-1 event that they mixed at the Amsterdam Arena. Of course, he blows out Azim Maksutaj with a great offensive flurry. Tyrone Spong, KO power in both hands, could fight from both stances. One of the meanest guys with step knees that you're ever going to see. He could definitely beat you with the low kick game, but really he could beat you with switch stance boxing, angles, and aggression. Tyrone was just that kind of mean, that kind of talent. He moved all the way up to, of course, being Tyrone Spong. He won the Glory Grand Prix at 93 kgs. He's a special fighter, but he had buzz. There was so much talk about this kid is going to grow into a heavyweight and fight the best guys in the world. It happened, you know. Tyrone Spong is the last guy I'm going to mention on this list. Some of you guys hear this kind of stuff, and you're probably wondering there are things that are left off. And, of course, there's always going to be something left off. A lot of people are big on Gokhan Saki, but Gokhan Saki had some mixed reviews when he fought at 80 kgs. He did better as he moved into a heavyweight, but there were some mixed reviews in there. When I did my upset show, Alex Roberts beat Nathan Carnage Corbett. That's one that probably should have for sure made the list. But sometimes I'm going to miss him, you know. Jorgen Kruth knocked out Stefan Leko. Cyril Abidi had a big-time big-time KO victory over Peter Arts when Arts was, you know, the man. There are fights that I missed when I did my upsets. And in that way, there are people that you guys are going to feel as an audience probably deserve to be on this prospect list. But I truly do believe, when I go off of the fight forums, when I go off of internet buzz, when I go off of Twitter later in the days, Dylan Salvador is another guy that I was torn on from France. Dylan Salvador, I'll go ahead and mention him as a sidebar. He had buzz, and then Thai Fight came around, and then Thai Fight gave him some opportunities for an international scene to see how good he is. Now he's competing against the best in the world, got a victory over Sitichai. There are guys that I'm going to miss, and maybe you guys are going to have your list. Maybe you guys are going to have female fighters that I miss. I don't think so, but maybe you are. But these are the elite prospects that you should really go back and visit. They had buzz. There are better fighters resume-wise, but as far as prospects goes, this is the list. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I really appreciate you following the show. It was a little bit longer today, but I started enjoying myself, and I got into my flow. So God bless everybody. Have a good one. Peace.